Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and this is the first part of a three-part program on the life and times of Lindsay Field. Born in New Zealand in 1950, Lindsay carefully, methodically, but in a most engaging manner, unpacks his early years as a boy growing up in New Zealand. His father was a senior officer in the New Zealand Air Force. Far from being an authoritative figure, he was supportive and encouraging of his son, and would later become the first professional chief administrator of the New Zealand Boy Scouts. Life was great for the young Lindsay, and generally his school experiences were very good, although there were some exceptions, such as when a teacher he had, who, on hearing of a large earthquake in Chile, scared the life out of the kids when he made them draw a tsunami crashing over their houses. The program is engaging, informative, and entertaining, and Lindsay takes us all with him. So, without much more ado, let's make a start. Lindsay, thank you for sitting down and talking to me. And could I start by asking you, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
I was born in Wellington, New Zealand on 16th of October 1950.
So that genuinely makes you a baby boomer?
Yes, a baby boomer.
What can you remember about your early years? What would be your earliest memories?
It's difficult now to discern what is actual memory and what is folklore.
Yeah.
When I was, I was an Air Force brat. My father was in the RNZAF. When I was 6 months old, he was the squadron leader, transferred to be the squadron leader at Lethala Bay in Fiji, in Suva, for a flying boat squadron. And so my first 3 years were in Fiji. And apparently, according to my mother, I spoke Fijian before I spoke English because she was swanning around having, you know, elevenses, being the CEO's wife, and I was raised by the Fijian housemaids.
Oh, right.
So, and it's interesting because I always wondered where my musicality came from, and Julie, my wife, and I went back to Fiji when I was in my 40s. I think it was in my 40s. Oh, God knows. Sometime.
Yeah.
And when we went there, I realized why I'd been traveling at a different speed to the rest of the Western world all my life, because I was still on Fijian time. And I knew all the songs. I had a familiarity with the language that was just innate. And it was a lovely thing to discover. And it made me, well, it made life a lot easier for me because I was able to relax and just accept the fact that I am who I am and not to try and worry about being somebody else that I wasn't.
Yeah. It sounds as though you weren't there for many years, though. If you don't.
No. We were back in New Zealand before I went to school.
Right.
At five, so we lived in the Marlborough Valley at a place called Woodburn,
right,
which was the Boy Entrance School for the Air Force, and my dad was the CO there. And I went to school at a little primary school called Renwick Town. And in those days, you know, which is famous now for its Sauvignon Blanc and wine areas, I don't think there was a grapevine within 100 miles of the place. It was just fat lambs and baby carrots for the Watties factory or the, you know, just no one.
I'd like to talk to you about your school experiences, but before that, you've mentioned your dad several times. What sort of person was he?
He was a very lovely man. He was a dignified, you know, he was a bit of your Clark Gable looking, you know, the little Air Force moustache and the aviator glasses, and very suave. You know, again, as those things get mixed up, you know, because I remember when he died that a lot of the attributes that we'd given him were actually my mother's.
Oh.
But he was a very kind, he was a wise man, I would say.
Did his job give him
time to spend with you, or was he fairly busy in his work?
He was pretty busy in his work. He was always pretty busy, but the time we did spend together was beautiful. I mean, you were asking me what my earliest memories were, and one of my earliest memories is being as a little child. You know how you go, I mean, you go to the bathroom and it's like, you know, Mom, come and wipe my bottom. And I have a friend who's mythical, who was real, but it's mythical to me because I have no memory of him and I haven't been able to find him since, whose name was Atu, a Fijian boy. And my mother was always responsible, Atu's wiping his own bum by now. What's the matter with you? You know? But they were very interesting people. We raised a deer because the boy entrance school would go up into the mountains, sort of in going bush, sort of survival type thing, and somebody shot a doe and there was a Bambi in the trap, so they brought it home. So we raised it as a family pet. And we used to be able to race it around the house. Nobody had any fences on this Air Force station until we got the deer
that changed things.
Yeah, well, everybody's flowers got demolished. Oops. It just ate everything. But that met a bit of a grisly end because it got too big to be able to keep. So we went out to my sister's godfather's farm and ended up garrotting itself after being spooked in a corral.
That's the way life is. Mm. Yeah. You've mentioned your mum a few times and you indicated that many of the attributes given to your father were really your mother's. So what sort of woman was she? What do you recall of her?
My mother was very much, you got one life, live it. Loved a party, just really a very infectious laugh. She was a very handsome woman. I mean, an example of my mother's sense of being, I suppose, is when I first came to Australia, there was like a little family diaspora. You know, my brother went to Canada to do a doctorate and my parents moved to Switzerland with my younger sister. I came to Australia, so just left my older sister, left in New Zealand. And during that time, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And she had a radical mastectomy. The next thing I get a photo from her standing in a sort of like 50s style tight sweater. And my mother, as I said, my mother's quite handsome and fulsome. And just written on the back of this photo was, guess which one? And that was it. Yeah. She decided she paid her dues.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was her dealings with it. And I mean, fortunately, the cancer never killed her. When she did die, she died because basically she'd had a few strokes and she wanted to go.
Yeah.
But she'd had her other breast removed when she's in her 70s, because she never had a reconstruction or anything. She never embarrassed about it. Yep. Just that was how it was.
It was. You mentioned your brother. Did you have brothers and sisters other than that one brother?
Yes, I have an older brother and older sister and a younger sister.
Were you close as a family, the siblings?
Yeah, pretty close, although with my brother's 6 years older than I am. And so being in the services, we went to boarding school. I went by choice. He went because of necessity, because you got posted every 3 years. And so Tony went to Nelson College. And because of that 6-year gap,
it's hard to bridge.
We didn't spend a lot of time together because then he was off at boarding school. And then when he finished, I started.
Yeah.
But we subsequently became very close. My sister's much closer too, because we all live together.
Sure.
Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Radio. I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with Lindsay Field, and Lindsay is recollecting his early life.
Primary school experiences, were they pleasant?
Yeah, I grew up in a little town called Paikakariki, which is the resting place of the green parrot. And it was basically a railway village where the steam locomotives switched to electric trains to go. We're to about 25 miles, showing my age, and going miles rather than kilometres, north of Wellington on the west coast. And there was an electrified line between Wellington and Pycock.
Right.
And they couldn't take the big KA locomotives because the tunnels were too small. So that was the reason this village existed.
Yeah.
Had a big railway yard, and you know, I can remember as a kid just the romance of just, on the one hand, it was a surf beach. We lived on top of a sand hill above the beach, and down in the valley behind us with a steam yard, the train yards, and you'd just hear these engines shunting, the great sound of steam. You know, my dad telling me that he was down because everybody used to go and nick the coal from the railway yards, and Dad saying he's down there with his wheelbarrow filling it up, and heard somebody on the other side, and he looked around the corner, it was the local copper filling his things and so on, and off he went.
It sounds like it was an adventure playground for a kid.
Oh, it was terrific. You know, it was a different era. We just got up in the morning, had breakfast, and went.
Yeah.
And in those days, we had the telephones were had a manual exchange.
Oh, okay.
So you'd wind the little handle, and the operator would go, number, please, and you'd say 365, please, and so you had a coded ring.
Yeah.
So you might be long, short, long, and then there was a particular ring that was meant everybody pick up.
Oh. What sort of circumstances would create that?
Oh, well, somebody would just pick that up, and everybody would pick up the phone and say, where are the kids?
Oh, okay.
You know, because I saw, oh, they're at Queen Elizabeth Park, or no, I saw them heading up to the Mungatooks, which were the hills behind us, or they were out, you know, fishing on the beach, or just, it was, no, it was just that interesting thing. And of course, you know, you always knew there was somebody listening in on your conversation.
Of course. But it sounds like it was a real community.
It was. It was at that stage. It was quite small. Later on, there was a place that was called the New Development, which was some empty sand hills that had finally been developed by somebody. But up until that stage, it was just sort of beach bum, beach comb. Well, not beach bums, because that people who lived sort of fairly bohemian lives on the beach, on beach houses and batches and things, and some commuters. We were belonged to the commuter brigade because my father would work in Wellington. So he'd catch the train in every morning and get home about 7:30 every night. So, you know, just as children, you know, it was idyllic because you just grazed wherever you were. Whosever house you were at, that's where you had lunch.
Yeah.
Or if you weren't at home, you just, you know, ate off the beach or...
It's hard not to generalise, but today, kids from very young age upwards spend more time in front of a screen, be that a small mobile screen or a large screen, than doing outdoor activities. There were no small screens then. There were no mobile devices, and I'm not even sure you had television at the stage.
No, didn't have television.
No television.
No television.
So what did you guys do to entertain yourselves?
We played. We dug forts. Being in sand, it was terrific, because we got very skilled at digging underground forts, but with appropriate bracing, and, you know, you didn't actually tunnel because you knew they were going to collapse. But if you dug a bloody great hole, put in some bearers and some posts and corrugated iron, covered it with sand, it was terrific. And we actually built a fantastic one in the empty section next door to our house, and I'd completely forgotten about it till my mother told me about the guy clearing the section with a bulldozer to build a house and going through the roof of this thing and
down,
crashing down a meter and a half into this big hole. But no, it was
a very healthy lifestyle then.
We didn't have a lot of money, so we were talking about this the other day, you know, about, I bet you ate a lot of lamb. And I said, no, we never ate lamb, because lamb was expensive, or lamb was always exported to England in those days for the common market. So we ate mutton, you know, it was two tooth or older, and you'd buy a side of it, you know, lots of offal. And my brother would shoot, so we'd shoot rabbits up in the hills, occasional deer. You know, my next door neighbour used to shoot pigs, so and we grew lots of vegetables, and of course we were on the beach, so we trawled for flounder and sole, pippies. My sister would get a bucket of pippies every day, you know, and just they'd sit in a bucket of seawater overnight, spit out all their sand, and then end up as pippy chowder or pippy fritters or just steamed pippies, you know, just down the south end of the beach was rocks because the hills just came straight into the sea, and there was all power, abalone, sea eggs, you know, crayfish. It was, you know, it was a amazing.
Yeah. Well, as you tell spot. It, I mean, it's the sort of food today that you would go to a very fine restaurant to eat.
Mm.
And but that was your everyday fare then, because it was around.
We'd go, depending on the tide, we'd get up every morning, and on the weekends, you know, we'd sell it all to the city slickers who would come out to go to the beach for the day, you know, and just walk along with your bucket full of fish and sell them for a 2 bob or whatever you could get for them and make your pocket money.
Now, you didn't have television in the evenings yet. What about radio? Did that play a part in the family life?
Yes, it did, actually quite a lot. And there were a lot of English radio serials and a few New Zealand radio serials, and also, interestingly, Australian, Life with Dexter.
Oh, right. That's
what
I forgot about that.
I can still remember the music theme of it.
The Commonwealth Savings Bank of Australia, the bank for all the family, takes pleasure in presenting the show for all the family, Life with Dexter.
And as a kid, I can remember I had a little crystal set because it didn't have transistor radios.
No.
But you had these little crystal sets, and it was in the form of a jet fighter.
Oh, cool. You
pulled this little thing out of its nose to tune it.
Oh, how cool is that?
And, you know, it was great. I'd go to bed and, you know, listening to, you know, My Word or Hancock's Half Hour or The Goon Show. I still love The Goon Show. I mean, I've even got The Goon Show app on my
phone. Most of us grew up with The Goons.
No big passengers out that door. So, radio was very important. You know, every Sunday morning, we would all get up and pile into bed with Mum and Dad, and we'd listen to, first of all, they had the request session where, you know, you'd write in. It didn't ring in those days.
No.
You wrote in and you requested things. So the first hour, I think, was the kids' one. So you'd be Diana in the Golden Apples, you know, like Rumpelstiltskin, just all of these wonderful things with Danny Kaye doing Gerald McBoing Boing. And I mean, just amazing stories that, you know, fairy stories, just all of the Grimm's brothers' tales, you know, with these wonderful radio plays, and you know, you just had this wild imagination that would happen. And then after that, the next hour was like the music, the parents' request session.
Yes.
So they would request their song for their partner or their loved one or somebody who was away, and you know, it was very cute.
Now, you mentioned earlier your love of music, and obviously as our talk goes on, we're going to investigate your love of music in some detail, but were your parents musical? Did they enjoy music? Did they play anything?
Oh, they enjoyed music. You know, I can remember my father very creatively building his own living room furniture, and it was just as things went to a stereo, and he had this wonderful system where he drilled holes in the door of the cabinet and mounted the speaker behind it, and then made a separate speaker cabinet for the, which was actually one we could, on a really long lead, we could take outside.
That was pretty
onto
progressive.
The front terrace.
Yeah,
it was all still mono then, I think, and but we had things like Marty Robbins, Gunfighter Ballads and Trail Songs. That was still is my favourite album. And he's a beautiful singer, beautiful voice. And that was, you know, they weren't active musicians.
Listen to older voices. The Magic of Memories.
You know, when I started to play, my father taught me ukulele. The very first song he taught me to play, which was now very politically incorrect, was The Laughing Nigger, which was released on radio as The Laughing Policeman. But you know, it was just those days, you know, we used to have gollywog dolls.
That's right.
That my grandmother knitted for us, and there was no connotation to it. It's interesting times. I mean, at primary school, it's quite different in New Zealand now. Now they teach Māori language. It's at primary school. In those days, I can remember Hanare Stretch being sent home from school for speaking Māori.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just he got in the shit for doing what for him was natural. So yeah. But it was an earlier day. You know, it's like that. You can see the same sort of ignorance in the community here in those that same era.
Absolutely.
I don't know if it was that much different in New Zealand. Well, the Maoris were never beaten, so it was a little bit different environmentally there.
Yeah. Come the turn of the decade from the 50s to the 60s, there's two things happening. One, you would have then gone to secondary college or secondary school around that period of time when you were 11, 12, 13, something like that. And secondly, of course, there was the beginnings of a musical revolution. Let's look at the school first. Your secondary school experiences, was that when you chose to go to a boarding school?
Yes, I was. I mean, you're coming out of an era there of the Cold War.
Yes.
You know, like just going to back up a little bit, we had a real ass face of a school teacher. His name was Bob May. So avoid him if he's still alive, but I very much doubt it. But he would tell war stories of a war that he never fought in. He was just a big noter and, you know, just to scare the hell out of us. There was a big earthquake in Chile and we had art class and he made us all draw a picture of a tsunami crashing over our house for that day, you know.
And lovely man.
We went home after school that day and was, okay, because we lived on this big hill, it's probably a couple of hundred feet high. Sand Hill. It's not big, but it's big for where we were. And we was all sat on the corner of the road on our bikes, waiting for the water to rush out. Because as soon as the water rushed out, we knew there was going to be the tidal wave. So we would bike like hell and go right up the hill road, up Pycock Hill Road, which was we would have been safe. But of course, we were actually on the west coast, and any tsunami was going to come from the east coast.
Yeah, but as kids, you don't think.
Yeah, between that and. There was some dude, I can't remember, who reckoned he'd had a bomb big enough to blow the world off its axis and that he was going to do this and that the only place that wouldn't be inundated was Mount Vesuvius. And so, you know, I can remember sitting outside at lunchtime at school and we were all looking up at the hills waiting for this bloody great wall of water to come over the top, scared shitless.
Yeah, I bet.
Or, then you think that the whole nuclear thing, the Kennedy era. So in a way, it was apart from, you know, the environment was idyllic, but the world was chaotic.
It
and
was chaotic.
It's no less chaotic today, of course. But so when I had the choice at that point, because we'd built a house, we were established. My father had actually left the Air Force at that point and became the first professional administrator for the Boy Scouts in New Zealand. He was the chief executive commissioner for the Boy Scouts. And, you know, he did a lot of reform there and put them in long pants. But, you know, much more than that. He loved working with youth. He always said to me, don't forget working with adults. He said, you can't change the bastards, leave them alone. He said, work with young people because that's where you can make a difference in the world. And so I didn't have to go to boarding school, and probably I put an undue burden on them by choosing to go, but I could have gone to Kapiti College. But at Kapiti College, most of the kids there left school at 15 and did an apprenticeship.
Right.
I didn't want to do that.
Did you know at that stage what you wanted to do?
No. Still don't.
Very healthy.
And also I had this romantic notion of you know, boarding school. You know, my brother tried to enlighten me, but I didn't, wasn't prepared to listen. And so I went off to Nelson College in South Island, which is where my father had gone to school. He was born in Canvas Town in the Marlborough Sounds. And my grandfather was the tally clerk at a sawmill. There used to be lots of sawmills there. And once the house got burnt down, and eventually they moved to Nelson during the Depression.
Join Lindsay and myself next week as he continues his school stories and we learn how he discovered he suffered from Bell's palsy. We also learn about his development of a career in music and his journey of self-discovery. Next week, part two of the story of Lindsay Field on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.